taking a new look at a controversial death in St. Augustine. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9, also never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen to us there anytime, or on iTunes, or on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, where this show is streaming live right now. Just ahead, New York Times reporter Walt Bogdanich joins us to talk about his update into the investigation into the death of Michelle O'Connell in St. Augustine. You can get on the line now with your comments and questions, 549-2937. Then later, a local charter school has its say about why they believe they should receive additional funding from the state. Plus, all about the new local magazine dedicated to downtown. It's called J. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, we've got an update on a controversial investigation in St. Augustine. It centers around the 2010 death of Michelle O'Connell. Now, this is a long-running drama that has divided the nation's oldest city, the law enforcement community there, and even O'Connell's family. By the way, her family believes that a new investigation is needed into this case, and they've been seeking what they say is their only chance at justice in her mysterious death. Authorities believe that the young mother fatally shot herself in September of 2010. Some of the late Michelle O'Connell's relatives disagree. They believe she was killed by her boyfriend, Jeremy Banks, a local sheriff's deputy. He denies that, and investigators to date say there is no probable cause. O'Connell's family wants an effort for a new state inquest into her death following a second and recent autopsy of her remains. And the New York Times has been reporting on this from the beginning and has more new information in the case. We begin the hour with a closer look. Walt Bogdanich is a reporter for the Times, and he's been covering this story from the beginning, both for the New York Times and the PBS program Frontline. He's on the line with some updates. Walt Bogdanich, thanks for coming back on the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And the number to join us as we talk about the new information into the death of Michelle O'Connell in St. Augustine, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on Facebook. And as I mentioned, Walt, you've been covering this since the beginning. Multiple investigations, most of them have ruled Michelle O'Connell's death a suicide. But new information has emerged in this case. Can you bring us up to date on what we've learned in recent months and why you decided to write a follow-up story for the New York Times on this?
I decided to write it because over the last 3 years, the sheriff, Sheriff Shore of St. Johns County, has been putting out his version of events and specifically attacking the conduct and investigative chops of Rusty Rogers, who was an FDLE agent. And I thought it was important to go back and to look at, you know, those allegations and hold them up to the light of day and see whether they stood up, because he was making serious allegations. So serious, pardon me, I've got a cold, so serious that Mr. Rogers was put on administrative leave for almost three years, took his gun away, his badge away. And what I found in looking at thousands and thousands of pages of records that were not available to me before, I found that much of what Sheriff Shore had been saying was basically innuendo and rumor, and that his men and he himself had not bothered to confirm, made no effort really to confirm much of what they said. And I just thought it was important for me to come back and fill out the picture, because it wasn't really being presented accurately by the sheriff, in my opinion.
And to be clear, Rusty Rogers with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement is back on the job today. He was brought in by the FDLE to conduct an independent investigation, correct, when there were initial questions about the initial investigation that the St. Johns County Sheriff's Department conducted into one of their own, Jeremy Banks. And let's be clear, he is not charged with anything, and he has denied any involvement in his girlfriend's death. So what are you saying then, Walt? What was alleged about Rusty Rogers and the way he was investigating this that you found troublesome?
Well, the statements that Sheriff Shore made about him just weren't true. And that came out clear as a bell when depositions were taken, when I examined interviews that were taken by FDLE's internal affairs investigators. All of my statements, all of the facts that I put in the story, my sources are all identified. And many of, a good number of Mr. Shore's own sources have told a different story under oath or in interviews with FDLE than the sheriff has presented. And so, you know, he was accusing Mr. Rogers, Agent Rogers, of all sorts of bad deeds, criminal behavior, really. And I should point out that that has not been sustained by the internal affairs investigators or by a special prosecutor.
We reached out to the St. Johns County Sheriff's Department and did receive a statement from Sheriff David Shore reacting to your recent piece in the New York Times. We'll post it later today on our website, but I'll read some of it here on the air, that he says that you, Walt Bogdanich, had already had your mind made up concerning this case, that you treated some of the staff unprofessionally, and that his primary source of information was FDLE agent Rusty Rogers, and that he goes on to say, you have never reported on the true narrative or legal findings of this case, but are instead working diligently to perpetuate his own narrative and act as an advocate for those who do not accept the suicide findings. Okay, so what about that charge back from the sheriff that you are advocating on behalf of the O'Connell family? And they've been consistent from the beginning, particularly Michelle O'Connell's mother, Patty, that she believes her daughter was killed by the deputy, Jeremy Banks.
I'm an advocate for the facts. I'm not an advocate for any side. That's what journalists do. They ask questions. And according to that statement, it's pretty clear to me that the sheriff is trying to change the subject. Let me be clear. He refused every single effort that I made to interview him, back for the first investigation that I did and the second one that I recently did. And I encourage everyone to look at it. Find it on the Times website, because Ms. Ross is going to post it, and she should. But they should also look at what I wrote and make their own conclusions as to, you know, where the facts lie. But, you know, as far as he said I was rude to his staff, you know, that is absolutely untrue. He thanked me for being a gentleman in writing when he thought he could control what I was going to write. And he said he hoped he could respond in kind. He thanked me for coming and doing this reporting. All of that changed when he realized that I wasn't going to parrot what he was saying. That's what journalists do. They come in here and they ask questions, and he interpreted questions as opinions. They're not. They're questions. He was saying I had a bias 8 months before we published our first story. He just doesn't understand how the news process works. And, you know, I mean, I can also make this point. He, so far, has not sought any corrections from our newspaper. So what he's engaging now is in just basic name-calling. And, you know, that's okay. He ought to say what he's going to say. I don't fault him for that. I mean, it's a free country. I have to stick to the facts, however, as a journalist, and we've done that.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking right now with the New York Times' Walt Bogdanich on his follow-up story into the long-running drama over the death of Michelle O'Connell in 2010 in St. Augustine and the follow-up investigation that centered around the St. Johns County Sheriff's Department's look at one of its own, O'Connell's former boyfriend, Jeremy Banks. And we want your calls at 549-2937. All right, let's talk about the new information, Walt. Now, as you report, according to your reporting, Rusty Rogers of the FDLE faced quite a bit of pushback from the St. Johns County Sheriff's Department after he turned up new evidence in the case. The most important piece of evidence, a couple of neighbors heard screams coming from Michelle O'Connell's residence shortly before they heard a couple of gunshots. That's one piece of evidence that's come out that's been reported. The other one that's new is that Ms. O'Connell's mother, Patty, authorized a private pathologist, a former medical examiner in Orange County, Florida, Orlando area, to exhume her daughter's body. And that pathologist discovered that Michelle O'Connell had a cracked jaw. He said he found that consistent with blunt force trauma. So this is new information. The mayor of St. Augustine, Nancy Shaver, has called for this case to be reopened. And this is something that's been going on now for 7 years. It's faced multiple pass-throughs via the criminal justice system. Three special prosecutors, more than one pathology report, more than one medical examiner report. This is such a long-running thing. Do you think this case, given the evidence that's now emerged, needs to be reopened yet again?
Well, I'll leave that to the authorities. I will say this, and it's a darn shame. The reason we're talking right now is because the sheriff initially botched the investigation, which he admits. I mean, they did virtually no investigation before quickly concluding that this was a suicide. And by not doing a good investigation, a lot of the evidence disappeared. And it's opened the possibility for a whole lot of people to say a whole lot of things that really would have been resolved right at the beginning had he done a good investigation. And there are folks out there that I've interviewed who say that all of these attacks by Sheriff Shore on Agent Rogers and now on me, you know, are pretty much an attempt to divert attention from his own failings.
And when you say, let me jump in, Walt Bogdanich, when you say failings in your reporting, what elements of the initial investigation do you find were botched?
Well, they didn't collect all the clothing. What evidence they did collect, they didn't send to the lab. They didn't canvass the neighborhood, among other things. It's a long list. And none of that came out until I came to town and started asking the sheriff questions. And he buried all of his mistakes on two pages in a 152-page attack on Agent Rogers. He admits that it wasn't a complete investigation. He does not admit that it was as incomplete as it turned out to be. But it was basically, he left open all kinds of questions, and that's why, you know, all this controversy is flowing from it. Let me make one point here that's important. You know, I never reached any conclusion in my reporting as to what actually happened in that room. I couldn't do that based on the evidence that was there. I did raise questions as to what possibly could have happened, but I never took a position despite what the sheriff is saying. And as far as Rusty Rogers being behind what I'm doing, that's absolutely false, and he knows it. The family got me involved in it. I listened to them. I looked at the evidence. I looked at the investigation that Mr. Rogers had done and that the sheriff had done. And I reached my own conclusions. I printed the facts, and they stand really unassailed as of today.
And we're going to go to some calls right now on this. Have you been following this long-running drama into the death of Michelle O'Connell in St. Augustine? 549-2937. Harold is on the south side. Harold, good morning.
Yes, good morning. One question. There were two gunshots, according to the article, which seemed very odd. And second, do you think that there's a possibility that the U.S. Justice Department could come in and investigate and give the family some closure?
Thanks for that question. Yeah, Walt.
Yeah, that's a good question. There were two gunshots, which in suicide cases, if that's what it was, one would say it's pretty unusual. It's also unusual, as one of the FDLE agents told me, to be screaming for help before you shoot yourself. Again, I'm not reaching any conclusions. People should reach their own after reading our articles and looking at the evidence. As far as whether the Justice Department should come in, well, again, that's up to them. If it would help put to rest some of the questions, then I think some of the people that I've talked to would say that that's a good idea.
You told the PBS program Frontline some years ago, when this reporting initially came out, that Michelle O'Connell had told people that she was planning to leave her boyfriend, Jeremy Banks, before she died.
That's correct. And as people who have examined domestic violence cases will tell you, that's the most dangerous time. That's when, you know, the one party feels threatened because the other's leaving. And in fact, she was packing to leave when this happened. So, once again, I'm not making any conclusions, but that is the facts. There they are.
You also write in your follow-up report just the other day in the Times, you asked these questions. How could a woman unfamiliar with guns withdraw her boyfriend's weapon from a retention holster? Why was a second bullet buried in the carpet several inches from her body? Why did she have a bleeding cut above her eye? And then there's also the new autopsy report on the broken jaw. All of that said, the deputy in this case, Jeremy Banks, remains on the job. He has maintained his innocence throughout, and he has actually filed a civil rights lawsuit against the FDLE agent who turned up in damaging evidence, Rusty Rogers. What's the status of that lawsuit?
Well, it's continuing, and there is no resolution to it just yet. Whether it goes to trial or not remains to be seen. I mean, there are decisions that the judge has to make as to whether it merits going to trial. But yes, I mean, he filed a lawsuit. That is his absolute right to do so, and he went forward with it. And at some point, you know, some of the facts that are in dispute right now may be, you know, ironed out.
Now, the tragedy of this story also is that it not only has it divided the community of St. Augustine, it's divided the O'Connell family. Patty O'Connell, Michelle O'Connell's mother, no longer speaks to her son, Deputy Scott O'Connell, who's also in law enforcement. Can you talk a little bit about that part of the story?
Well, that is really tragic. As the mother, Patty O'Connell, told me, she lost two of her kids because she doesn't want to have anything to do with Scott O'Connell, who is now a deputy. Just for your listeners, a little background, he was fired when he protested, got very angry that the prosecutor was not going to take action against Deputy Banks. And only after he came forward and said that he was manipulated by Mr. Rogers, and I should point out that that the authorities, by that I mean the FDLE internal investigator and the special prosecutor, really didn't find any real problem there. Only he claimed he was manipulated by Mr. Rogers into thinking that Mr. Banks had shot his sister. And so, you know, the sheriff immediately hired him back and trotted him out as evidence that he was right and the family was wrong. And that's how he plays the game. He's a tough source.
Let me point out
one thing. You know, you mentioned the three questions that I raised. And one of them was this cut above her eye. Everyone said that there was no evidence of physical conflict before, but that doesn't explain why this bleeding cut, a fresh wound, was above her eye. And the explanation from the medical examiner and the special prosecutor is that a gun recoiled forward. Now, I ask you, you know, how does a gun recoil forward? It doesn't. Physics dictates that it goes backwards, and that's what all of our experts said. Well, that's how they explained the cut above her eye. So there were a lot of questions to ask, and I raised them. That was my job.
You report as well that one of the medical examiners that took a look at this, Dr. Hoban, changed his initial finding from suicide to, quote, shot by another. But that's not a unanimous finding because lots of different authorities have looked through the evidence, correct?
Well, let me be clear, because one of the misstatements that the sheriff has been making over and over again is that the special prosecutors concluded it was a suicide. They did no such thing. They just decided that there was a rule that there was not enough evidence to go forward with a prosecution for homicide. So that's one point. There were Dr. Hoban, who was the first medical examiner who actually did the autopsy. He failed to note in his report that the victim's jaw was broken. You would, even though it was on a post-mortem X-ray. Dr. Hoban is a very nice man. I've talked to him many times. He first ruled a suicide, then he changed it to shot by another. At another point in time, he changed it back to suicide. And at another point in time, he told in a taped interview a local newscaster that he really didn't know what happened in the room. And that, you know, so, you know, you basically have four different opinions there. So it's kind of hard to sort through all that and come to a definitive conclusion. But I go back to the point that a lot of the evidence disappeared. And in a lot of that can be traced back to the sheriff's poor initial investigation.
Okay, speaking of the sheriff, in part of his statement to WJCT, he writes, one key item that I'm sure Bogdanich has neglected to report is that his friend and source, Rusty Rogers, that's the FDLE agent that was assigned to do an independent investigation into this, is 60 days away from standing in federal district court in Jacksonville, where he will be compelled to explain to a jury of his peers why he engaged in the outrageous conduct that he did in this case. What is the substance of that allegation that Rogers engaged in the sheriff's words, outrageous conduct?
Well, that's the sheriff's opinion. I should point out that not only will Mr. Rogers, if it goes to trial, have to testify under oath, but so will Sheriff Shore. So that will be interesting to see what he says under oath, because so much of what he said so far has not been held up under the light of day. First of all, I'm not, you know, to say that I'm a friend of Rusty Rogers, let me point out one thing. All of my sources in this story are identified. And I think I quote Mr. Rogers one time and only because it was from his deposition. So for him to sit there and say that he's behind what I'm doing is just, he's making it up as he goes along.
Given that there's this new autopsy evidence from the new, the exhumation of her body, how powerful is that evidence in the family's attempts to pursue this case further?
Well, in their opinion, it's powerful. The other side will point out, by that I mean the sheriff, will point out that this was not an officially sanctioned autopsy. But I think what some people that I've interviewed found incredibly disturbing were the sheriff's comments when he learned that the mother was exhuming the body, something that authorities thought about doing but didn't do. And he called the decision by the mother to exhume her own daughter's body reprehensible for, quote, molesting her in her place of rest. That's some pretty strong language to be delivering and to be piling on top of a mother who lost her daughter.
You also and you also report that two different Florida medical examiners have been disciplined over their handling of the evidence in this case. Why?
Well, Dr. Hoban, he was keeping some important documents in his home rather than the office where they were not accessible. And the second medical examiner who came up with the idea that she turned the gun upside down and that the gun kind of kicked forward to inflict that wound on her face, he, without permission from the family, had allowed people to walk in off the street and look at autopsy photos of Michelle O'Connell, and that is against the law.
You've been to St. Augustine several times now, and you're reporting on this. You've talked to a lot of people, and as you write in the Times, this is really a case that has divided the community. What's been your experience of that as you go around and talk to lots of folks that have an opinion about this case?
Well, it's very emotional for obvious reasons. I mean, here you have this incredibly, you know, appealing young woman with a four-year-old daughter who, as we said, was shot to death. How that happened, I guess, is still to be determined. But the jury is ultimately out on that, possibly. But, how did that happen? And why did it happen? And, you know, how thorough was the investigation? So, I mean, the elements are there for a real tragedy in so many different ways that people just want to know. They want to know what happened. They don't want to know why it happened, how it could have been prevented. you know, it's just one of those cases.
Well, we thank you for joining us with this update and being on the line with us. We really appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
That's Walt Bogdanich, reporter for the New York Times, covering the death of Michelle O'Connell in St. Augustine. And much more still ahead on the show later. It's an upcoming event for local veterans who need help from their fellow vets. But up next, local charter schools make their case for state funding. Back in a moment.
The ATM turns 50 years old this week, and hoo boy, has banking changed.
They used to give you toasters and have all sorts of fun things for you to do in the bank if you would open new accounts. It was a social activity.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy birthday to the ATM. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Next time on 1A, bringing big tech to small towns. Steve Case, the co-founder of AOL, wants to build interest in startups outside Silicon Valley, New York, Boston, and Seattle. His journey took him from Hawaii to the White House. How do we build a tech economy in the heartland? We meet Steve Case at the Aspen Ideas Festival, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
How is Jacksonville spending our tax money? For years, city leaders have talked about bringing jobs and updating infrastructure to make the city more attractive. But are those investments spread across the city equally? Join our panel of experts and moderator Melissa Ross for a live, interactive, televised discussion. Community Thread, City Spending, Where Should Our Money Go? Thursday night at 8 on WJCT-TV and 89.9 WJCT-FM.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Welcome back. Well, earlier this month, Florida Governor Rick Scott signed a massive and controversial education bill into law. Among other things, the new law will make it easier for private charter schools, privately managed charter schools, I should say, to further expand in Florida and to receive additional taxpayer funding. Now, the measure was roundly criticized by many public school advocates, but cheered by supporters of charter schools, which do qualify as public schools in the state. This morning, we continue our look at the new law as we welcome two local voices and a spotlight on one local charter school. Here with more, we welcome Sharon Sanders. She's principal at Seaside Community Charter School in Atlantic Beach. Good morning. Also with us, Katrina Hall, PhD. She's associate professor of literacy and early childhood literacy with the Department of Childhood Education, Literacy, and Teaching English as a Second Language at UNF.
Thank you. Good morning.
good to see you. And the number to join us, 549-2937. Sharon Sanders, let's begin with you. You're the principal at Seaside, a popular local charter school in Atlantic Beach. And one of the reasons you asked to come on the program today is because you felt there were misconceptions about the way charter schools are funded and managed in the state of Florida. Correct?
Correct. Absolutely. We find that many of the criticisms about charter schools are, in fact, about the management companies that run many charter schools. Our particular school was started by a group of local parents and educators from the university that wanted a different choice for their children. And that is really the heart of what charter schools are meant to be. They're to be innovative and they're to give choice to parents that would prefer something different for their child. And every parent has the right to choose if they want more art and music and language, or whether they want more math and science. And we have to understand that developmentally, all children don't need the same thing. So we were founded on the premise that this group of parents wanted something that was research-based, sound educationally. They wanted it to be a public school, and we are a public school, a tuition-free public school. We're a part of Duval County Public Schools. We follow all of the state statutes, all of the requirements of a public school, and it is just merely a different option for parents that give them a chance to look at their child as an individual and what might be the best educational choice for their child.
And Seaside follows what's known as a public Waldorf model, one of the only ones in the Southeast. What's that model?
The Waldorf model is developmentally appropriate. It's more of a holistic education. So we often say that we teach the head, the heart, and the hands. The head is what you would find in most traditional elementary, middle, and high schools, which is the academic piece, and we certainly do that. Academics are important, and they're rigorous at our school. We are currently designated as an A school by the state of Florida's Department of Education. We're very proud of that. We've worked hard for that. But we also spend time teaching the heart, which is teaching children to be kind, empathetic, compassionate. We spend time every day talking with our children about making good choices and how to be a good person. We feel like if we can teach them to be good people, that is equally as important as the head. The hands is really unique to Waldorf education. We teach work. So we spend a lot of time with our children talking about everything in life is not easy. You're not going to be good at everything you do. It's going to require hard work to be successful in life. And so it's the combination of all three aspects and a nurturing, loving environment that really sets us apart in a different choice for parents.
Katrina Hall, what would you say to advocates of traditional public education that really expressed opposition to this legislation the governor signed? We're talking most of the superintendents around the state, most of the elected school boards, parent groups, teachers' unions. Their big complaint about this is that districts now will share with charters millions of local tax dollars earmarked for school construction. They see that as a further diminishing of traditional public schools.
I think one thing to consider is that charter schools are tuition-free public schools. They are part of a district. Though in Florida, we have a local education agency, which for us is Duval County. And so the application and the contract with the district is approved by the school board. I think one of the misconceptions is that the big management companies, those may need to have more oversight. But with regard to our local governing board, they're local business people in the community, local educators. They file a monthly report to the district, a financial report. They're audited by an external audit firm each year. And so I think that concern about the money being mismanaged is maybe misplaced with regard to a lot of the charter schools.
You're saying don't paint all charter schools with that same brush.
Exactly, because the charter school that I'm part of, which is Seaside Community Charter and now Seaside Charter K-8, which will be over in San Jose, I became part of that because I found that I'm a very big advocate of public education, but I found that what we were moving away from is what we know works with children. So when Ms. Sanders is talking about the head, heart, and hands, I see it from the research base of the cognitive development, the emotional development, the physical development. And in fact, our school probably, we're more aligned with the Alliance for Childhood or the American Academy of Pediatricians that advocate for recess.
Okay, let's go to Kara on the west side. Kara, you're on the air.
Hi. I just think it's interesting that you brought somebody on from the most popular charter school in Jacksonville. Everybody screams about choice, but can I enroll my child in there next year for preschool? What are the odds that my children would get in if I have all of choice?
Yeah. Kara, that's a really good question.
And let me just tell Kara quickly. Kara, the reason we booked Seaside is because they asked. They reached out to us and asked for this time on the radio.
I'm sure they asked because they want to screw all the poor children. They don't care. They just want the money from the bill. So they want to throw the one good charter school in Jacksonville? I'm disappointed in you, WJCT.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
I'm disappointed in you for having them on.
All right. You know what? I appreciate your frustration and your anger. Let me say that I've also taken a lot of heat and flack from big supporters of charter schools around this region who feel that we have an agenda against charter schools. We don't. Our mission is to host people on all sides of this issue. That's why these ladies are here right now. Okay, all of that said, Katrina, there's a lot of anger against the charter school movement. So what about that? That's legitimate anger out there.
I think one thing that needs, and Kara, I just want to address this to you with your question. With regard to charter schools, the contract that is approved by the district has an enrollment cap. And so charter schools will enroll any child as long as there's space. And with regard to the first charter school application, I was one of the primary authors, and I actually made the mistake of having an enrollment cap that was pretty low. And so that's the reason that children might not be able to get into that. With regard to the Seaside Charter K-8 in San Jose, that's going to have a larger enrollment cap. But because we want to focus on the quality of the education, we start off small. So there's no intent to exclude any child from the school. And eventually we will be on the west side.
Sharon Sanders.
Yes, I want to speak to that also. We actually, all students are welcome and can apply. And we are actually...
But will they get in?
Well, there's a lottery. That we are held to a lottery, and so once the
like some magnet schools,
yes,
public magnet
just
schools.
Like magnet schools, and so parents can apply, and based on the number of seats that are in our contract, when the school is full, it's they make the application. As long as there are seats available, they're accepted. There's no screening process. There's no reason why any child and all children are not welcome. We service a diverse population. Everything from learning differences to medical differences to all kinds of backgrounds, family backgrounds. So that part of it, there is no discrimination there. What they may have run into is if the school is full, then the applications each month go into a lottery, and they're put on a waiting list from a random selection. So there is nothing that's trying to keep anyone out. It's merely the numbers in the contract.
Mike on the south side. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Boy, this is a real contentious issue, and justifiably so. I share some of the previous caller's concerns, but I don't want to put you guys on the ropes. I'm encouraged to hear what you're saying, but a lot of the things you're saying about what makes your school different or why you did this school or what were the motivations are pretty much the standard boilerplate for every single charter school out there. They all say, we're doing something different. We're doing something evidence-based. We're doing they all put themselves out there touting what they're doing better. The reality is that the only reports out that say that charter schools are better are put out by the charter school industry. Most independent reports show little to no advantage of charter schools, and some of them, one good report that came out a couple of years ago showed that very few of them perform. I think it was 17% performed above the level of public schools. Now,
yeah. Okay, I hear you, Mike. And Mike, we're a little tight on time. Yeah. Let me get them to respond to you. Katrina.
Okay. Mike, I think that's a good comment, and I will agree with you that a lot of charter schools are not actually innovative. And ours is only innovative in that we actually do have research-based practices. We John Hattie put out a book called Visible Learning, and it was a meta-analysis of what makes successful schools, and we follow that. We look, I do the research.
And how would you call the track record for achievement at Seaside?
And our track record is good.
What are you rated?
Well, right now we're rated as an A.
An A school.
I will have to say that, it will just depend on, the formula for that changes every year, so I can never tell. But Mike, I would ask you if we would love for you to come visit the school, and you can also email me at UNF. It's khall@unf.edu, and I'll be happy to answer any questions or give you some of the rationale for why we actually are different from a lot of what people might think.
And we've got more people waiting to appear on the program. How about this? I'll make this commitment, a follow-up segment on this topic.
Awesome.
There are more callers than there are time. Katrina Hall from UNF, Sharon Sanders, principal at Seaside Community Charter School in Atlantic Beach. Ladies, thanks for being with us. We'll continue to follow this on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Back in a moment.
Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, The Dark Side of Manifest Destiny. Michael Wallace tells us the story of the Donner Party, a band of pioneers who set out for California in 1846. After getting treacherous advice on the route, they found themselves snowbound and starving, forced to feed on the corpses of those who died. Wallace separates fact from myth in his book, The Best Land Under Heaven. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Do you want sexy skin? Dr. McGettrick with Dermatology Specialists of Florida will help you to feel your best and learn how to protect your skin. Join us for Girls Day Out, Saturday, August 26th at the Hyatt Regency, hosted by WJZT and Baptist Health. Tickets are just $40. Log on to wjzt.org/girlsdayout and get your tickets today.
For the next Jazz Night in America, Joshua Redman confronts his past.
This is definitely the first time that I have explicitly, with any project, kind of acknowledged my father's influence and the bloodlines or whatever.
And we've got the music of Old and New Dreams live at Jazz and Lincoln Center. I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, they're called Vets for Vets, an organization drawing hundreds of veterans from across this region. Their goal, to inform, connect, and organize local veterans. And they've got a big gathering coming up in a couple of weeks at Veterans Memorial Arena. Bob Adelhelm is a lieutenant colonel with the Marines, retired, and he's here now with a preview. Lieutenant Colonel Adelhelm, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity.
And we do have an arena called Veterans Arena. You're going to gather together all the veterans in the area on July 15th. What's going to be happening?
Well, first, we're not an organization. We're a movement, and we did that purposely so that we would not interfere with any organizational's agenda or the egos of the leadership. So we just basically started it as a movement. And that movement encourages veterans and veterans organizations to attend, and veterans organizations can send representatives. We meet in the Veterans Memorial Arena quarterly, and we do that purposely so we don't interfere with the scheduling of any of the veterans organizations, which do a lot in this this area of Northeast Florida. Mm-hmm. But we start off at 11 o'clock, and we have speakers on subjects that are of interest to veterans and their families. And then at 12:30, we have a lunch and about a half hour's worth of time so that the veterans can network with those who spoke. The lunch is free. Parking is free. And we usually have about 180 to 200 people show up. We've had as many as almost 300, but that was during election time.
Yeah. But there's strength in numbers. When you get everybody together, a lot of interesting connections can be sparked.
Correct. What we're finding is Jacksonville is such a large geographical area, and there's a lot of good things that happen all over Northeast Florida, but they never really connect. So what we want to do is not have these little bubbles of good things. We want to put a big bubble together so everybody was under that one big in that one big bubble sharing information, and that's what Vets for Vets is all about.
Right. And so this is a way then, and you do these quarterly. This is going to be the second quarter gathering.
Well, our scheduling is dictated by the scheduling of the arena. They have generously given us a space and provide us with the lunch. So we can't dictate to them when we want to meet. So they give us a schedule based on their scheduling. So this would be, the second quarter, but it slipped almost into the third quarter.
Into the third.
Yeah.
And what do you find the veterans that come out, what are their biggest challenges? Employment, or is it a host of things?
Well, a lot of the veterans are coming out. Most of them are Vietnam vets. They're elderly, getting up there in age. So their issue is the VA issue, connecting with, the VA reps and service officers. And then the young vets that are coming out, the Afghan and Iraqi vets, their issues are, again, connecting, camaraderie, and also some job issues. A lot of them already have jobs. A lot of them in school. What we find with the young vets is alienation. And I think that's being misinterpreted in some respects as PTSD. But what we're hoping to do is we bring the older vets together with the younger vets, and we start to develop mentoring with the older vets who've been through a lot of the issues that the younger vets are going through now and can help them with those hurdles.
Yeah, that mentoring piece could be so powerful. So let's put the call out again. If you're a veteran, Vets for Vets wants you to come out to their gathering. This is coming up at Veterans Memorial Arena on July 15th. Kicks off at 10:30 a.m. This is a Saturday morning.
Correct.
And people can get their tickets where?
There's no tickets. You just
no
show
tickets.
Up.
Just show up.
10:30 to 11 is a coffee social. You can come in and you might run into somebody you served with or somebody you know from Jacksonville. And then at 11 o'clock, we start off with the speakers and we pretty much rock and roll through till 12:30 and then lunch.
Very nice. This is a free event open to all veterans. Saturday, July 15th. Veterans Memorial Arena. Come on out and be part of Vets for Vets. Bob Edelhelm, Lieutenant Colonel with the Marines, retired, speaking for the organization. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And finally, this hour, we're going to take a look inside the pages of the new magazine, totally devoted to the growth of downtown Jacksonville. J Magazine is a publication of the Florida Times Union. Have you seen it? The new issue is out with a big picture of Shad Khan on the cover. Editor Frank Denton is here now with Look Inside. Hey, Frank, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So the Times Union has championed downtown with a whole magazine dedicated to its growth. What prompted that decision?
Well, we've covered it, obviously, for years and care deeply about it. But we care so much that we wanted to – we got tired of waiting, as most people in Jacksonville are, that we have fits and starts, and downtown is just not – become what it should be, despite its many charms. So we decided to call the question. It's our editorial board. Now, I emphasize that the news coverage of the Times Union is not directly involved in the magazine, so they can cover it impartially. This is the editorial board and the leadership of the Times Union making a statement that now's the time to come together for downtown.
So you're planting a flag for downtown. In essence, you're taking a position, I guess, on the growth of downtown with the publication of this magazine, becoming a champion, really, for it.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
It's not something that we particularly sought out to do, but we need to do it, and it's part of our role as a community leader, and it's something that we can do. So we are taking an editorial position.
And with putting Shad Khan, Jaguars owner Khan, on the cover, you've also given his efforts to revitalize particularly the downtown shipyards project a lot of publicity. How strongly do you feel as editor of the paper that Khan's role in all of this, based on my perusing of the magazine, you see that as critical?
Well, yeah, I should quickly say that I've stepped aside as editor at the end of the year. I'm now editor at large. I'm editor of J Magazine. Mm-hmm. In my cover piece for the magazine, I lay out four big reasons why now is the time for downtown to come together. And one of them is what I call the mojo of the magnate, which is Shad Khan, that he adds an ingredient to it that other cities, well, most other cities don't have. Some cities do, with a major league sports owner who can provide the magic sauce and the final ingredient to local leadership.
And so is it your hope that 5 years from now, you'll still be publishing J Magazine, or will downtown still will it be so amazing that you'll be onto a new venture?
You know, I think it'd be great if our downtown became so great that people are having so much fun there they didn't have time to read J Magazine. But right now, the city needs it, and we started it just for that reason, to provoke the city and inspire with ideas and information and hard reporting. And this is not a feature magazine. It's
and there's
tough
a lot
magazine.
Of stuff in here. I read the whole first issue. How can people get their copy?
Well, it was home delivered. All of our 7-day home delivery subscribers, it was in their paper a week ago Monday. Otherwise, it's available single copy at the Times Union at the front counter or at some Daily's, Publix, and Gate stores. So you can look for it. But if you can't find it, go online to jacksonville.com and you can find out how to get it, or just drop by the Times Union on Riverside Avenue.
And out of all the ideas that are presented in this, what do you think is the key piece?
Well, we quote a guy named Ennis Davis, who's a citizen member of our editorial board, and he's an urban planner, and he talks about the chemistry that you need to make a downtown viable, and it has to do with compactness and complementarity and things coming together. And that's happening with the Shipyards, the Lar Street Trio and the Barnett Bank, the Elbow Entertainment District, and maybe someday the Landing, if they can get out of court and get to work on making the Landing what it ought to be.
We'll always be following it here. In the meantime, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Frank Denton, editor of the new J Magazine. Pick up your copy now at multiple locations all around town. And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen anytime. Next on 1A, the final countdown for Republican plans to repeal and replace Obamacare. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.